and welcome to Ubuntu Podcast Season 13, Episode 9, recorded on the 19th of May. I'm Alan. I hope you're doing well. I'm joined once again by my compadres, Mark. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
I am also doing well. Thank you.
Good, good. And Martin, how are you?
Yes, a little bit sweaty, but other than that, fine. It's a bit warm this evening, don't you think?
It is close, as my mum would call it. I've never heard anyone else call a warm day close other than my mum. But yes. So what have you been up to, Mark?
I have been getting a little bit older and hopefully a little bit wiser.
Oh. Well, what happened?
It was my birthday.
Oh. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Are you 12?
Yes. Times three or something.
Did you get any nice presents, like sponsorship of a donkey sanctuary or something? What did you get?
I got some beer and some chocolates and some vouchers to buy games.
Yay.
And books and, you know, the kind of things that you get when you're in your 30s and don't need lots of toys anymore.
Are you going to use those vouchers to buy any RPG games with roguelike elements?
I might dabble.
I think it's highly likely, unless it was vouchers for board games.
Oh, now I know what I'm asking for next year.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on clinging to the rock that's orbiting a sun. Well done. Well done, you.
Many happy returns.
Thank you.
Martin, what have you been doing? I bet you haven't been getting older, have you?
Well, I have been getting older, but I'm not a year older, just older. Got longer hair, longer greyer hair. That's what I've noticed. Also, the longer my hair gets, the more distinctive my bald spot gets. It's it's the strangest phenomenon.
I have to say, I never noticed you had a bald spot, Martin.
Yeah, well, you flatter me because I know that's not true.
You can't see it from here.
No, it's because I've only got a front-on view with the webcam.
Yeah, well, no, I've been occupying my time working on the OBS Studio snap.
Ah, this is a labour of love, isn't it?
It has been. I think I'm about done with labouring on it now, but I have given it a lot of love for sure. I'm quite pleased with it. So taking advantage of one of the unique qualities of snaps, which is you can put whatever you please inside it. I've been doing a bit of live streaming, as I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, and obviously using OBS for that. And I watched some YouTube videos on like essential plugins to make your stream better and faster, stronger, all of those things. And turns out most of those plugins are available for Linux. So I've been adding a collection of plugins into the OBS Studio snap. So you get like this batteries included version of OBS Studio now.
Oh, nice.
It's interesting that people do have quite a lot of plugins that they add. There's like the base functionality, which is you can record the screen and stream. Mm-hmm. But then there's this whole bunch of stuff that people stack on top to make it a richer experience and integrate with Twitch and YouTube and all this
right.
stuff that, you know, is way beyond like my capabilities. I know you've turned expert mode streamer over the last few months, but
I've figured out the tools. I don't think I've figured out the presentation and production values yet, but hopefully having an OBS with like 20 plugins in it, it'll be good. I mean, we've got this. So there's a unique advantage. The snap has the browser plugin. That was a new feature for the Linux version of OBS 25. And it's not available, you know, in the archive and in Debian. So the snap has that. And then input overlay, so you can do controller overlays, WASD and stuff. So as you're playing the game, you can see the key presses and button presses of your controllers nice. Overlaid on the screen. One called Move Transition, which does these really cool animations. So if you have the same element in different scenes, it will do these nice sweeping animations as that element moves between the scene transitions. There's some really cool stuff. And then like the NDI plugin, which is the current hotness, and then the virtual webcam stuff, and then WebSockets, so you can install remote control apps on your phone and do like Stream Deck stuff using apps on your phone. So there's a whole heap of things. Yeah, really cool. Yeah.
I notice it's also got a DVD screensaver plugin. That sounds useful.
It is the most meme-worthy plugin that I've added, yes.
Seriously, is this just like the bouncing DVD logo
exactly
that everyone
what
cheers
it is.
When it hits the corner?
Yeah.
Right.
The README actually just says, will it hit the corner?
It does. Oh,
brilliant. Okay, well, I think we've peaked, but let's try and do the rest of the show anyway. So let's have a look at some of the news and events that have been going around in the Ubuntu community. And first off, I found that Ubuntu 2004 LTS is now certified on the Raspberry Pi. There have been images around for the Raspberry Pi for a while, haven't there, of Ubuntu? What does it mean to be certified on it?
Means it has factory level assurances from us that it is guaranteed to work.
As opposed to a random download that may or may not work. It's gone through QA.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, random download that may or may not work. See ubuntumate.org for the Raspberry Pi images there, for example, you know, put together by some bloke in his bedroom for fun versus, you know, actually, you know, guaranteed to function and work reliably and correctly across, I think it's the 2, 3, and 4 that we're certifying at the moment.
Mm.
That's excellent.
It really is. So, you know, one of the series of live streams that I've been doing is taking those images and writing a tool that converts it into, you know, converts the server into a desktop operating system. And the, you know, Ubuntu on the Raspberry Pi is a very different thing today than where it was even a year ago. You know, it's really robust and well supported. And there's lots of cool new things coming along as well. I'm looking forward to this cycle. We've got some interesting stuff we're doing on the Pi.
I noticed the blog post has a screenshot. It's written by Rhys Davis, who is a product manager at Canonical. And the screenshot that's in the blog post is of the Raspberry Pi Imager, which is a piece of software the Raspberry Pi Foundation made a little while ago. It's a bit like Etcher or any of these other things that are used to put an image on an SD card. And I made a snap of that and published it in the store. And the nice thing is about this, which makes it different from many of the other flashing tools, is you just point it at the SD card. And when you say select image, it provides a pre-filled list of like Raspbian, OpenELEC, and Ubuntu is in there as well, obviously, and a whole bunch of other images. So you could just pick from a list and then just hit the write button and it will download the image and then stuff it onto the SD card to make it super easy for people who, you know, just want to put an image on an SD card for a Pi. I think it's, I really like that Raspberry Pi imager. I use it all the time.
In fact, it's even more clever than you've just described because it doesn't download and then write it. It streams it. As it downloads it, it writes it.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
No, neither did I until I was like, hang on a minute. This just seems to be doing something. And I know I haven't downloaded anything. So I went and poked around in the code. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's really nice. Mm. Cool. What's next, Mark?
Well, in things not dead news, Unity is not dead. Thanks to the Ubuntu Unity Remix release.
Yes. So, well, there have been a few attempts at making Ubuntu Unity remixes. There's a few people making spins or whatever.
Yes, I think there's one called Umix, which is a bit customized and has like a Mate version that looks a bit like Unity as well as a Unity desktop. But this one is designed to be a bit more of a vanilla, just Unity experience, I think.
Yeah. I tried it out, spun it up in a VM, and it's, you know, just like it was a few years ago. It doesn't look an awful lot different and behaves the same. And it's all built from everything in the archive. There's no PPAs. There's no additional software bundled on there. It is literally just like having Ubuntu, I don't know, 14.04, but built on the latest kernel and having all the latest repositories and latest software. It's quite tugs at the old heartstrings for those of us who really enjoy using Unity.
That's interesting because I've not tried it out yet, but you know, Unity is an interesting remix because unlike the other flavors, you don't really have to decide what it should be because that's all defined. And I think unlike, is it Umix? Is that the other one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just sticking with that tried and tested formula is the right thing to do. Because if you've got that, you can then just focus on quality, you know, elsewhere rather than, you know, deciding what your default apps are going to be. What's your default theme going to be? All that sort of thing. Just, you know, just reproduce what went before.
And also the amount of work involved in making this wasn't as significant as it might have been for other flavors or remixes, rather, where they have to pull together software and maybe package it and put it in a PPA and maybe try and get it in Debian and then try and get it in Ubuntu. They don't have to do that because it's all already there. They're really, it's like a lot of the work is done for them. And the thing that I really like about this is it was made by a young chap who is 10 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's what I really like, is that there is a younger generation coming through who are excited to create things and make things. Okay. He's remaking a desktop from before he was born, but you know.
Oh God, that makes us feel old. No.
Yeah. Well,
how long have we been doing this podcast?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's cool. Anyway, what's next, Martin?
Well, there was an interesting article out this week that posed the question, should Microsoft buy Canonical?
Oh, that old chestnut.
Yeah, it's time for that one to come round again.
Yes.
It's quite an interesting read. Chris Petchman, I think is how you pronounce his name, from build59s.com, wrote up a rather good sort of insightful piece that was more deep than, you know, most of these, you know, questions. They really sort of put some thought into it, and, you know,
it wasn't just clickbait.
Yeah. So I mean, Mark, you've read this. What do you think? Do you think Microsoft should buy Canonical?
I'll reserve judgment on that. But I think just some of the things that he explores are interesting. I mean, there's the obvious things about, you know, Ubuntu's very popular on Azure and they're doing WSL. But then he also sort of looks at things like, you know, if it happened, how much might they pay for it based on what they paid for things like GitHub? When you look at, you know, what Canonical's revenue is and how that scaled up when they bought other things, and also talks a bit about whether Mark Shuttleworth would remain as CEO if Microsoft did buy it, and if not, what would his role be? Would he have some sort of Linux leadership role within Microsoft instead? Or would he just take all the money and go to space again? Who knows?
I think the thing I find fascinating about this is usually it comes up as either an April Fool's joke or the reverse April Fool's joke, which is Canonical will buy Microsoft, right? Yeah. These stupid joke articles, or people writing semi-serious articles about it. I think this is the best one so far, like you say, Martin. He's actually put some thought into it. It's a little bit better than most of them. But people keep asking, when these articles come up, they poke people who work for Canonical. It's like, oh, is it going to happen? Oh, you're going to, how would it feel if you were working for Microsoft? They always pose those questions. And I don't know. I have no idea, but I also have no idea. Like, this is all obviously way above my pay grade. Yeah, sure. There could be conversations between people at these two companies. Like, there's no way I would know that.
Yeah. I mean, should Microsoft buy Canonical? I mean, the article does say this, unlike every other article on this topic before, which is there's only one person that can know whether this would happen, and that is Mark, because Canonical is a privately held entity. Mm-hmm. So it would all be down to him. And I'd be amazed if people have not approached Mark over the years, you know, trying to make speculative acquisitions.
Well, people have a word with me on occasion, but I just show the door usually.
And you never know what they've offered either, you know, whether it's been the $3 billion or £2.50 and half a pound of grapes, or somewhere in between. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, next up, OMG Ubuntu have an article about System 76's Pop OS 2004. And the title is 2004 is here, and it boasts impressive new features. The main feature that I think has been touted is the tiling window extension that allows you to do really easily carve your screen up into the different applications you want to have open, which seems to have become popular again. I don't know what it is, whether it's a resurgence of nerds who like tiling window managers, or whether i3 and DWM and gtile and all these ways in which you could do tiling have just got better, or they've just been more prominent. I don't know. Maybe their marketing is it. The i3 marketing department is doing really, really well right now. And a lot of people like this.
I think it's a bit like I use Vim, and you make that statement as a badge of honor because you have mastered how to use Vim. And I feel like it's a bit like I only use free software. It's another badge of honor. And I think the current badge of honor is I use a tiling window manager because I'm a power user.
Mm.
I just feel like that is a movement within the Linux enthusiast community that isn't like fresh new. It's been building over the last sort of, you know, 18 months or so. You know, the regularity with which tiling window managers crop up on videos on YouTube and library is trending up. You know, it's definitely a thing people are into right now.
Yeah. So that's the main thing that everyone seems to have focused on. There are other additional things over and above what Ubuntu provides as the base, because obviously Pop! OS is based on Ubuntu. They have a repository of their own, which is, it's like a PPA, which has additional packages or packages which are newer than the ones that we ship in Ubuntu, because we have, I think because of the SRU process in Ubuntu, sometimes packages take like a week to land. But because the System 76 people have their own PPA, they can just ninja packages straight into that PPA super fast and deliver it, you know, arguably faster than us. Whether you prefer that or not, you know, some people like the idea of move fast and break things, and other people like QA. I don't know. It's I'm not throwing shade at Pop. I'm just having a bit of a joke. But yeah, it seems you know, relatively popular. There's a lot of people talking about it, and that's great.
Next up, UBPort's OTA 12 release is out. So this is the next upgrade of the UBPort Ubuntu Touch for Phones OS. And it is integrating the last of Canonical's Unity 8 developments. So I'm not sure exactly how that process worked, but apparently when Canonical stopped developing Ubuntu Touch, there were some things in Unity 8 which weren't in Ubuntu Touch, even though Ubuntu Touch was using Unity 8.
There were feature branches that hadn't been merged into master and made it to release. And I think it was depending on like technology such as, you know, MIR and systemd and stuff like that, that meant those features hadn't landed yet. And now UBPorts have done all of that work. They're able to now go back to those features and bring them in.
Oh, cool. So stuff which had sort of moved faster on the desktop but hadn't caught up on phones for all the reasons it's hard to do things on phones. The underlying stuff is now all there, right? So this includes a new version of MIR, which crucially I think supports Wayland apps now as well. So that could mean that we see more apps coming to the phone in the future without them having to be specially developed.
Is this an appropriate time to point out that MIR is still alive?
I think that was implied.
Okay.
I think we got that, yeah. We've already had one thing is not dead yet. this episode, I think we don't want to overload it with two of them.
Part of our shtick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I updated my OnePlus One that has Ubuntu Touch on it. And yeah, the upgrade went through fine. It was.
Did you notice a difference?
I didn't notice a significant difference, but all I did was update it because I was tidying up and I thought, I know what's on that. That's got Ubuntu. So I just charged it up enough that I could update it and then put it back in its box. I don't have time to play with it at the moment, but I do dig it out every so often and turn it on. And I have a game of Machines versus Machines, which is the best game on Ubuntu Touch. It was written by Michael Zanetti, who was one of the developers on Ubuntu Touch. And it's a great, what do you call them? Tower defense game. It's got catchy music, and it's when you put it on the hard levels, it's quite frustratingly hard to play in some of the later levels. So yeah, if you've got an Ubuntu Touch device, install Machines versus Machines. It's worth playing. It's good fun, and I'm sure there's lots of other things in Ubuntu Touch that's great, but that's the big thing I play on it. Final item in the community news, Martin.
Microsoft have announced at their build conference that WSL is going to get support for GUI apps, but more importantly, GPU pass-through.
What? This is a thing that's been asked for since day one of WSL. Everyone tried to do all kinds of tricks in order to display graphical applications launched from WSL, and now it's coming officially to be supported.
It is. Now I have some insight on this. One of my roles is leading up the team that looks after WSL in Canonical, and Hayden and Patrick have been working towards this, you know, wanting to get here. And Microsoft have decided that they are going to implement this as an official capability. But the GPU pass-through is, as you can probably imagine, mostly there so that you can support compute workloads from the Linux, you know, the Windows subsystem for Linux. So you can run things like, you know, Kubernetes clusters with GPU pass through. So you can get access to all of that commodity developer tooling that we have in Linux and then run that on Windows.
So these fun things that we see that use things like TensorFlow,
right?
You could potentially run that inside WSL rather than installing Linux on the bare metal. You could have your Windows workstation install WSL.
Yeah,
and then whatever your wacky AIML thing is, and have access to the hardware underneath.
Yeah, we're working really hard to make sure that Ubuntu on WSL is just like Ubuntu anywhere else that you can find Ubuntu. So it isn't treated differently, doesn't behave differently. It can do all of the same stuff. And Microsoft are doing, you know, the heavy lifting behind the scenes with the Hyper-V backend in order to make sure that all of those capabilities exist for the distros that run on top of WSL.
It's funny you mentioned that Microsoft are doing heavy lifting. I keep seeing this guess online that we are doing all the work and we're giving all of this stuff to Microsoft and we are to blame for Linux Linux on Windows becoming popular and we did all the heavy lifting. And actually, there's a team of developers at Microsoft who are working on this stuff across a number of disciplines. It's not it's not that we're just giving away the family gold to to another company. They're spending money on engineers to do this work.
It's amusing to think that people think that Canonical's developers would be able to just, you know, implement stuff like that in Windows.
Right. I think they think that we do the Linux side and that's the bulk of the work. I think they think that we are molding Ubuntu in order to be functional under WSL. I'm sure there's a bit of that, but whenever I talk to Martin, there are two people on the WSL team, and that's not, you know, a giant team of developers that we're spending billions on in order to, put our technology on Windows. Yeah. It feels like it's a symbiotic relationship, and they're doing a lot of work as well.
Exactly. It's Microsoft are creating the platform that is WSL, and we are one of the people that are making sure we offer a great experience on that platform, which is, as I said, trying to make Ubuntu when it's on WSL. But we have done a lot to make it popular. You know, we have worked very hard in actually saying that Ubuntu is available for WSL and look at all the cool stuff you can do with it. So we are helping in that regard.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not trying to play us down. I'm trying to play their part up a bit.
Yes, without doubt.
Okay, that's the end of the community news. And now it's time for proper news. First up in proper news, there was an interesting article I saw doing the rounds this week, and it was on ZDNet and by someone called Liam Tung. And it had a kind of clickbaity title. You know, once you see the title, you know exactly what the content is going to be. It was basically quoting Microsoft saying, "We were wrong about open source, but luckily you can change." So the implication here is they've come to the realization over at Microsoft that actually all those negative things they said in the past about the GPL, about Linux, and how open source was the right methodology for software development and distribution, you know, it turns out maybe they weren't right all those years ago. And 1,000 nerds rejoice and said, "Yes, we told you so." And, you know, this is the counter argument to a leopard can't change its spots. It's like, well, you know, clearly they can and have, but some people just refuse to accept it.
Did this feel a bit like to you, you know, sometimes countries have come out, you know, decades or hundreds of years after some sort of war atrocity and apologized for the acts of their country retrospectively? Did this feel a little bit like that to you, that they needed to put this one to bed?
I'm not entirely sure international reparations are in order here. And I'm ensuring we don't go down a certain path of conversation that I think a lot of people are thinking we're going to go down. But there are certainly... So the perspective I have is that it is possible for companies to change. Don't trust any company. They can all screw you over. But it is possible for the direction of a company to change under different leadership. And clearly they have a different leadership, and clearly they're changed. And companies do different things. The example I give people is Nokia was a pulp mill when it first started. It didn't make mobile phones and masts and antennas and stuff like that. And Nintendo used to make playing cards. They didn't make electronics and video games. Companies change over time. The problem is we're living through it. Like, I didn't live through Nokia being a pulp mill, and I didn't live through Nintendo making cards, because that was 100 years ago. But I have lived through this, and I think that's the problem, is the all the people who lived through Microsoft being awful, and they were awful, are still holding on to those memories and still, you know, mentioning the whole embrace, extend, extinguish constantly.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm coming from. So we this, you know, Linux is a cancer, that quote from Ballmer, which is, well, there's a longer quote than that, but that keeps being dragged out in certain quarters. And I wondered if this was like, we were wrong, everyone else was right, let's just bury that, like, Linux is a cancer statement. It's behind us now, let's all move on.
I mean, it was 4 years ago Ballmer said he was wrong about that statement. So, you know, but 4 years is not a long time in computing. 4 years ago, the Ubuntu 16.04 release came out, and that's still supported. So 4 years is not a tremendously long time. Next up, Martin.
So some academic supercomputers in Europe have been hacked. The Archer supercomputer is the one in question. Anyone like to take a guess? What do you suppose happened when these computers got hacked? Supercomputers, bear in mind.
So these are very powerful computers that can perform many operations a second.
Particularly good at number crunching.
Probably going to be crypto mining.
Ding! Well done, yes. apparently some of these computers had their SSH credentials compromised, and then the attackers were then able to island hop across a distributed collection of supercomputing nodes around Europe and developed some crypto mining malware that they had deployed.
Did it masquerade as System D, by any chance?
It's a well-known ruse, that one.
Yeah, so people wouldn't have noticed it, consuming all the CPU utilization on all the systems.
It did make me wonder a bit, like, reading through the story and then sort of seeing, oh, and they installed crypto mining software. Because, I mean, the real impact that this had was it shut down quite a lot of research projects, which at the moment are probably focused on one thing when it comes to big number crunching. But then you say, oh no, they were actually crypto mining. It seems like that's an obvious way to distract from what might have just been an attempt to disrupt a load of research, and then say, haha, look at what we've managed to do. Well, you stick crypto mining on, then everyone says, oh, they're obviously just trying to crypto mine.
I don't know. It does feel like if you're going to bust into some super powerful computers while you're there, why not? Just like it always feels like the bad plot of a Hollywood movie where, you know, someone has a plan to do something, and then at the last minute while they're there, they do an extra little thing just to, like, you know, punch them in the gut. And this could just be that. Like, yeah. While I'm here, I'll just drop a Bitcoin miner on here, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, Mark alluded to it, but the Archer supercomputer had recently been installed with pandemic modeling tools and was, you know, working that particular problem. So it has disrupted some rather timely and important research.
Hmm. In other better news, though, Mark, what else has happened?
Well, the NHSX team have released the beta version of their contact tracing app, which includes releasing the source code and a bunch of the architecture documentation on GitHub.
Is this the Android and iOS applications that detect or record the Bluetooth IDs of people around you so that in the event that someone is determined to have something, it can they can determine who has been nearby or which devices have been nearby so they can be alerted and you know, let them know to go and seek help.
Exactly.
It's that application.
It's that application. So there's several sort of versions of this sort of thing which are being developed around the world, and this is the one for the UK, which has kind of gone it alone a bit in that they have taken a centralized approach to recording or to determining when you should be notified that you might be near someone who was infected.
Or might have been near someone who's been infected.
Yes. So the way that Apple and Google have collaborated on an API basically means that your phone will check a database of essentially anonymous IDs and your app will decide if you have been near one of the IDs which has been flagged as being infected and let you know. Whereas the way that this has been determined it should work is that you tell the central database that you've been infected and it then does some algorithm and decides that who should then know that. This has raised some privacy concerns.
Really?
It's also raised some technical concerns about whether it will be able to work on the devices if it doesn't do it the way that Apple and Google want you to. And there's also been some security auditing done to identify some potential security issues, which are both sort of technical issues to do with how things are encrypted, but also potential leaking of additional behavior about what you're doing, which might not be what the app was intended to do.
I find the app interesting. Now that it's on GitHub, I'll be able to file a bug because in the application, there's a button you can press to show what the current advice is. And it shows a box that says, you know, stay at home, social distancing, and it gives you the date updated 1st of May, 2020. And then there's another box immediately below that that says this guidance was withdrawn on the 11th of May, 2020 and gives you a link to the new guidance. But that link is not clickable and it's not selectable. You can't. Oh, actually, you can. You could copy and paste that into a browser, but you can't actually click on it. Why the app keeps the old guidance right in front of you and tells you this guidance is out of date. You need to go and read this other web page over here for the actual guidance is a bit weird. It's a bit of a strange way to do it.
It is only in a trial at the moment. And given that you don't live on the Isle of Wight, it's not currently intended for you to see it.
No, but the people who are on the Isle of Wight would see the same thing that I'm seeing because it's the same app. And in fact, if someone who was on the Isle of Wight and was infected and happened to cut across the Solent and be near me, then I might have the value of having been someone who has the app. So even if I'm not on the Isle of Wight, there's still the potential for benefit. Anyway, that's the end of the news.
Thank you all for joining us for episode 9 of season 13 of the Ubuntu podcast. If you'd like to get in touch between shows, please email show@ubuntupodcast.org or join our Telegram channel, ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. We're running a crowdfunder at the moment. This is so we can outsource some of the show production and get back to a weekly cadence of podcast releases. You may have noticed that our podcast release schedule has been a bit patchy for season 13, and we'd like to fix that. So if you enjoy the podcast or you find value in it, then please head to patreon.com/Ubuntu podcast and chip in and help us out. In any case, we'll be back next week when we'll be discussing where in the world do people hang out and discuss Ubuntu. Talk to you then.